Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, April 18, 2019. Activists in South Sudan worry about the future of South Sudan's peace deal. And South Sudan government urges the extension of the pre-transitional period.
That delay also may have an impact in a way or the other on the establishment of the Artigono and the states, because this body is supposed to come up with a number of states.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Ousted President Omar al-Bashir and his government tried to suppress hundreds of thousands of protesters by restricting popular social media platforms. But as Ayen Dengbio reports, those attempts failed as millions of Sudanese found ways to circumvent restrictions and rally others to peacefully protest.
On the night of April 8th, just 3 days before Omar al-Bashir would be deposed, Sudanese native Sarah al-Hassan had her eyes glued to Facebook and Twitter. Live videos from Khartoum were streaming onto her computer screen in her home in Phoenix, Arizona, and information was flowing through her Twitter timeline. Social media was the most effective way for her to connect with fast-moving developments back home. She says it kept Sudanese in and out of the country connected, but it also kept them safe and informed.
I don't think this revolution would have happened without social media, in my personal opinion. It's been an integral part of the resistance movement, whether it be through sharing information, coordinating, people coming together to sharing the news of what's happening on the ground and getting it to be covered by news outlets.
NetBlocks.org, a social media monitoring platform, reported during the course of Sudan's revolution that social media platforms were continuously blocked in Sudan, even as the protests intensified. Users, however, used VPN circumvention tools to defy the ban. Last Thursday, NetBlocks reported that Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, and other social media platforms were fully restored the same day that the military announced al-Bashir's ouster. Social media proved to be crucial because the state had a tight grip on local media and freedom of the press was restricted, according to some local journalists. With a ranking of 175 out of 180, Sudan is one of the least free countries in this year's World Press Freedom Index. Reporters Without Borders, who publishes the index, says journalists and media were among the leading victims of the crackdown during anti-government protests since December. In January, the Committee to Protect Journalists reported the government revoked credentials for 6 foreign journalists, a move CPJ said was an attempt to muzzle the press during the period of unrest. Alawiya Mukhtar, a journalist in Sudan, says the former regime's repression of the press meant that journalists like herself had to find alternative ways to receive and disseminate information.
Of course, the social media played very big role in the Sudanese uprising revolution because the Sudan main media were blocked to report about the protests. Even the international media were not allowed to report.
Translations from Arabic was also done in real time by native Arabic speakers on Twitter and Facebook in order to share developments to a wider audience. Sudanese translators for change translated tweets and Facebook posts to inform organizers and the world at large. Social media was also used to combat fake news or misinformation, according to Ismail Kushkush, a Sudanese reporter and former acting East Africa bureau chief of the New York Times. He says this time it was also used for security purposes.
It used to be that many activists would approach the usage of social media without paying much attention to the importance of security, and that's how many were tracked down, and many of the protests and demonstrations in previous years were countered by government security. At this time, there was greater attention to the importance of maintaining security.
For the past week, since the military announced the end of al-Bashir's rule, many Sudanese have said they are already enjoying greater freedoms, including freedom of expression, something al-Hassan hopes is the new norm.
Sudan has been living in darkness. The NCP regime, the Bashir regime, has really capitalized on disconnecting Sudan from the rest of the world. Nobody really knows who we are or what we're going through, except for little snippets that make their way out. But the day-to-day, nobody really knows. The actual reality of everyday Sudanese people's lives is unknown to the vast majority of the world. And through, I mean, the social media has only helped in exposing not only what's happening in terms of the revolution, but what's happening to people. The fact that we are able to share our stories to a wide audience that surpasses, just our immediate, our country or our region is something, is incredible.
But the fight for a free and inclusive Sudan continues, according to Al-Hassan, who says the revolution is not just about ousting the government. It is about completely overhauling Sudanese society. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
Sudan, without former President Omar al-Bashir, faces many challenges, both in its governance and as civil society. The protesters' demand for a transitional civilian government after decades of military rule raises the question of how those shaping Sudan's future will avoid the past mistakes, a question on VOA's this week's Plugged In with Greta Van Sestran.
Protesters in the streets of Sudan may have been overjoyed, but the civilian government they are demanding is not in the immediate future. Ousted Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir faces indictment by the International Criminal Court, charged with directing a genocide against civilians in Sudan's Darfur region. The man who now heads Sudan's interim military council, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah Burhan, has pledged to having a complete civilian government. Foreign policy analyst Kelsey Lilly says any transition to a civilian government will require strong diplomacy by the United States and others.
The Sudanese want the state-sponsored terrorism designation lifted, and that's because not only it has this security element to it, it suggests that they aren't sponsoring terrorism anymore, but it also unlocks really desperately needed debt relief. And so that will be something that is on the table when this new government is constituted and the U.S. will continue some of its engagement.
Many of the Sudanese who were instrumental in the protests in Sudan were women. One who became an iconic figure is Alaa Salah, a 22-year-old engineering and architecture student. She became an internet sensation when a photo of her atop a car surrounded by protesters went viral. Salah received death threats and hate mail for her role in the uprising, yet remained defiant. The role of women in the protests is an encouraging sign, says Dr. Sarah Abdel Jalil, who heads the Sudan Doctors Union in Britain.
I think women came across very strong because there has been a lot of suppression and they have been sort of hidden away intentionally. It's very positive to see that the 30 years have not destroyed the Sudanese women power and ability to fight.
On April 16, Sudan's military transferred Bashir to a prison in Khartoum, where he is reportedly being held in solitary confinement. Robert Rafel, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan's government says the formation of the new transitional government may be delayed since some important tasks in the September peace deal have yet to be completed. As Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba, South Sudan's information minister says one of the sticking points delaying the formation of a new government is the unresolved issue of the number of states and their borders.
With 3 weeks to go before the transitional government of national unity is supposed to be formed, the government says it wants to consult with other parties to the agreement. South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay says the government wants to form a new government by the May deadline stipulated in the peace deal, but doubts it will be met.
So as NPTC, we have decided to compile, we have asked all the security organs and institutions that are established by the agreement, we have asked them to submit their written reports, their written progress reports, so that we compile all these reports, and then together with our opinion, we call the parties to the agreement and put it before them. That is the situation. What is the way forward? They will be the ones to decide. If they say If they agree to establish the Artigono, that is fine. The Artigono will be established.
Makwe says it is up to the parties to agree to still form a new government in May or to amend the revitalized peace deal and allow extra time for the parties to complete the task in their agreement. Rebel leader Riek Machar told Reuters while attending a spiritual retreat in Vatican last week, he wants the pre-transitional period to be extended by another 6 months. Makwe says some important bodies, including the Independent Boundary Commission or the IBC and the Technical Boundary Committee, have yet to submit their reports.
That delay also may have an impact in a way or the other on the establishment of the Artigono and the states, because this body is supposed to come up with the number of states so that we divide the number of states in accordance with the percentages that came in the agreement. But we are now coming to an end, and the IBC has not yet. Not that only, they are still receiving written reports.
According to the agreement, the IBC was scheduled to complete its work before the end of the pre-transitional period. If it fails to do so, the agreement states the IBC should be transformed into a referendum commission to organize a referendum before the formation of the new government in May. Rajab Mohandis, director of the Juba-based Organization for Responsive Governance, says the parties should delay formation of the new government.
We are concerned that the primary objective of the pre-transitional period, which was to reorganize the security sector in South Sudan into a unified security sector with the forces under a central command, has not been achieved. And in that way, as it stands now, we still have several forces under different commands and militia groups affiliated to these different forces. And these forces combined are a threat to peace and to the peace agreement and to the people of South Sudan.
Mohandis says the security arrangement is key to having lasting peace in South Sudan. He warns without it, fighting could flare up across South Sudan again. Makwe says the SPLM-IO has made an official request to delay the establishment of the new government. He adds the National Pre-Transitional Committee will hold a meeting soon to make a decision on the fate of the new government, which is supposed to be formed by May 12. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A South Sudanese lawmaker has ignored politics and is living a normal life in a refugee camp in Uganda. 52-year-old Oliver Muli was a former minister of local government in the former Central Equatorial State in 2015. Muli abandoned his political career and decided to live among refugees despite opportunities to join rebel groups. Wake Simon Wudu visited Muli in Morobe camp and files this report for VOA from northern Uganda.
From drafting laws to managing poultry, that is what the South Sudan conflict has done to former South Sudanese politician Oliver Muli. Muli ventured into farming in 2017 when he arrived in Morobe refugee camp. He says farming has helped him to avoid depending on UN food assistance.
I thought that it is good to embark on farming. I started as a subsistence, but I thought that it would not help me since there is accessibility to land. And we have to thank the host community for that purpose. I'm not saying that everybody might be easily accessing the land.
Insecurity and other issues prompted Muli to leave his home in Kajokeji. As a refugee, he grows a variety of crops for domestic consumption. Last year, Muli says he had 10 acres. This year, he is preparing to harvest 18 acres. Muli says his success depends entirely on the seasonal rainfall in Uganda.
Unfortunately, there was a problem with the weather. Rainfalls were very erratic so much that we could not even expect to harvest much. So That one still does not discourage me.
Mule is among a small number of South Sudanese politicians who abandoned politics and decided to start a new life at a refugee camp despite an opportunity to join a host of different rebel groups fighting the government of President Salva Kiir. He says he decided to join his community from Kajukeji at the refugee camp after the SPLM-IO and government forces fought over control of his hometown, forcing thousands of families to escape to neighboring Uganda. He says since the entire population of villages in Kajukeji moved to Uganda, there was no reason for him to stay behind.
In fact, to me, there was no reason for me to continue staying in the parliament when things doesn't seem very good for my people whom I'm representing. I don't see any reason at all.
Mule is not convinced that security arrangements in Kajukeji will hold. He says the security situation in Yei River State is unpredictable at best.
Up to now, we do not see something that is attracting, you know. There must be something attracting people to go back home. Say, for example, today, if I have gone to Kajukeji, as an ordinary person, I'm not supposed to go and stay in the commissioner's compound where there's a lot of security and protection. I'm supposed to go and stay in my home. Is there security for me at home there when I'm seated alone freely? You know, this is the issue here.
The former lawmaker says South Sudan's warring parties should give peace chance so that some 2 million South Sudanese who fled the country to neighboring countries can return home. Mule is urging President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to live by example and show confidence and leadership so that South Sudanese can live in peace at home. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the United Nations is calling for the protection of workers globally. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the best and worst thing about the first day of school?
You get to meet new friends, you get to interact with others apart from home. But still, I will still have that part of me missing my family, my siblings, all the laughter, all the jokes we've grown. So it's going to be a bit 50-50, actually.
All in all, the worst things is also, since it is a new environment, adaptivity matter a lot. And also, you start counting down, when shall I get back, what can I do with this and that.
It is the best when I meet my friends, because it make me to socialize with them. Because if I'm alone at home, sometimes I feel lonely if there is nobody at home. But if I came and I got my friends, to feel happy to be among them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A UN agency says the existing methods of protecting workers from accidents and disease are not good enough to deal with new occupational hazards arising from changes in the nature of work. The International Labour Organization is calling for revisions to address physical and psychological problems stemming from the changing job world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the report was released.
Recent ILO estimates find 2.78 million workers die from occupational accidents and work-related diseases each year. It says more than 374 million people are injured or fall ill every year through work-related accidents. The cost to the world economy from work days lost is nearly 4% of global gross domestic product. The ILO's report warns the changes and dangers posed by an increase in technology could result in a worsening of that situation. It says new measures must be implemented to deal with the psychosocial risks, work-related stress, and non-communicable diseases resulting from new forms of work. It says digitization, artificial intelligence, robotics, and automatization requires new monitoring methods to protect workers. Manal Aziz is an ILO technical specialist on occupational safety and health. On the one hand, she says, new technology is freeing workers from many dirty, dangerous jobs. On the other, she says, the jobs can raise ethical concerns. She tells VOA, surveillance of workers has become more intrusive, leading them to work longer hours, a situation that may not be ethical.
Also different monitoring systems that workers wear. Before you would punch in, punch out. Now you could wear bands on your wrist that show how many hours you're actually working in a production line. And there's even discussion of introducing implants where workers can be continuously surveyed on their production processes.
Aziz says a host of mental problems could be introduced by new work environments. The report also focuses on changes in demographics. It says employers have to adapt to the physical needs of older workers who may need training to safely operate equipment. Another area of concern is climate change. The ILO is positive about the green jobs being introduced, but it says care must be taken to protect people from warmer temperatures that increase risks, including air pollution, heat stress, and newly emerging diseases. In the past, creating a safer working environment focused on the prevention of risks. Authors of the report say the ILO today needs to anticipate the risks. They say new skills and information about safety and health in the workplace have to be learned at an earlier age. Before young people apply for a job, they say they should know their rights. The power of knowledge, they say, will help protect employees in the workplace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Millions of people in the Horn of Africa are suffering from food insecurity. That's according to a regional bloc of African member states. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, officials say immediate early warning interventions are required to mitigate the worsening drought crisis. VOA's Robin Chama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Mahbub Maalim, the executive secretary of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, says more than 10 million people are affected in Somalia, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Uganda alone.
It's going to be critical. And therefore, as a result of all this, we are now estimating 23.4 million people who are affected so far in the entire IGAD region, with, of course, a worsening trend quite visible. Right now, those groups are being seen to be people who are in kind of a stress, a drought stress level situation, with pockets of emergency almost.
With a delay in seasonal rains, coupled with expected rain deficits, experts say there is a high risk of food insecurity for communities in other countries too, including Djibouti, Eritrea, and South Sudan. Gulaid Atten is the director of IGAD Climate Prediction and Application Center, ICPAC.
Most of the eastern sector in our region is under drought. We are in the long rainy season that starts from March and goes to May. The eastern sector, southeast Kenya, northern Kenya, most of Somalia, small part of the eastern part of Ethiopia, they will receive below average rainfall. Usually, this month of April actually is the peak rain season.
The poor performance of the past season's short rains already led to a below-average crop production and deteriorating pastures in some agro-pastoral and marginal mixed farming areas. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders said it has launched an emergency intervention in the southern part of Ethiopia and urged other humanitarian agencies to urgently scale up their support, especially for the internally displaced persons. Abdi Jama is a senior advisor on food security, nutrition, and resilience.
The issue of food crisis is not new. We used to have it from time to time. But now it's the increased frequency, it's the complexity of these things, going conflict, migration, internal displacements, that are making it very much difficult to deal with. It's also the impact that these things have, not only within our national borders, but in the whole region and globally sometimes.
Current projections suggest a worrying regional nutrition outlook, with the situation likely to worsen in the coming months. Some 2.8 million children under five are likely to suffer from acute malnutrition in Ethiopia, according to aid agencies. In Somalia, 900,000 children are facing malnutrition, as well as 500,000 in Kenya. Cyril Ferrand is an official of the UN Food Agriculture Organization, FAO.
East Africa is really the part of Africa that is the most severely hit by drought all over Africa. And then since 2015, what do we see in the region? Almost a permanent succession of natural hazard. Either it is drought, either it is flood, but we have this permanent succession of natural hazard.
Experts are urging governments and the donor community to respond urgently to the deteriorating food security and nutrition situation with immediate and coordinated planning. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Rwanda ranks number 155 out of 180 countries on the 2019 World Press Freedom Index, compiled by Reporters Without Borders, which said censorship and self-censorship reign in the country. Media analysts say poverty of the media houses and the political environment make the situation worse. Another dozen African countries rank in the bottom 40 of the Press Freedom Index, including Burundi, which recently banned the British Broadcasting Corporation and the Voice of America. Eritrea was at number 178, ahead of only North Korea and Turkmenistan. The highest-ranked African country was Namibia at 23. Eugene Uimana has more for VOA from Kigali.
The report says that since 1996, 8 journalists have been killed or have gone missing in Rwanda, and 35 have been forced into exile. It states that in recent years, the number of abuses recorded has decreased, but censorship and self-censorship remain. Ngwari John William is a Rwandan journalist who has been in the media industry for 19 years. He says self-censorship has another context in Rwanda.
Website.
It's not easy to file reports. On a website, even that journalist who managed to write good article can't publish it as he wants. We read articles, but in a moment, it is scrapped. There are others who are threatened when they refuse to delete the story due to the facts he thinks he has. All of those issues made some say it's self-censorship, but it is not.
Kwiniga, self-censorship, ariko nyese mbita kwiniga, burya abayanizwe binyuze mu zindi nzira.
Many in Rwanda's audience don't know how to judge press freedom. They say they consume whatever they are served. But Fakulera Emmanuel, who lived in Kigali, wonders why investigative reports are rare compared with other developed countries.
I'm not satisfied with this reporting style in Rwanda. I think media houses don't tell investigative reports that we should listen. I don't know whether it's due to political restrictions or Rwanda's historical background.
According to Christopher Kayumba, a Rwandan media expert, African media houses won't be free as long as they are not economically independent. If the African press still lives in poverty, when journalists are not well paid and work professionally, even that one who wants to censor will get their way. Reporters Without Borders says despite a new media law in 2010 in Rwanda and efforts to develop the internet network across the country, the legal framework remains, as the new penal code even penalizes editorial cartoons. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with Nyankol singing about her heritage. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Come on, baby.